Recently, I think people are waking up to the reality that administration is part of the music business. The structure of the industry is being run by the older generation. They don't have any idea about music streaming methods and all that. Young people are busy doing music, the older people are busy doing the administration. It just cannot work. Artists should not just rely on streaming services. As long as I done a Mandela song, and when I went to see the downloads on MCA, or Coca-Cola Tunes, it was making about $40,000 a month.
Do we have that much money in music?
Yes, we do have that much money in music. Every time music is being used, money is changing hands. Every time music is being downloaded, money is being used.
How did you even get there?
In 2015, in South Africa, Runtown was in town in Johannesburg. I called him up, went to the studio and did a song called Viva Mandela. I sent it to Banky W, Casper Nyovest from South Africa. We did the song, sent on MCA, and we did it. We had 10 million downloads.
10 million.
Yeah, 10 million subscribers. Music money is crazy money. There was a World Cup song that came out with Shakira.
I read that Shakira had to give the group about $400,000.
It's a much more substantial fee than that. That was an advance.
How much was that?
Yeah.
I call it a 1 billion story, talking about birthday wishes.
It's about strategy. I wouldn't say either is better.
You said that the South African music industry is more valuable than the Nigerian music industry. What was the metrics for that? What's your relationship with Jovi now? Are you a fan of the 80-20? What's up, my friend? Welcome to this episode of DRAB. And before we jump into today's episode, I'd love to specially invite you to take 10 seconds and join our 21,000 plus smart friends on emails. I've been sending out emails for the last couple of years, and a bunch of friends always write back. Thousands of them will say that this is the favorite thing that they look forward to on the internet. So once you join our 21,000 plus smart friends, you're going to get an email from me once every month. Plus, you also receive an email every time an episode like this goes live. If you're brand new to the community, I'd love to say welcome. And this is the space for you. So please hit the follow button so that you can get notified every time an episode like this goes live. And also, don't forget to check out the links in the description for really helpful resources that can help you to connect with the guests and also to kickstart with whatever thing you're building. I wanted to ask you, where did the name Mr. Arrogant come from? I mean, of all the names to choose.
It's online, so I can't really explain. People choose what to call you. It's kind of a name that I picked up from Clapbacks online, but yeah, it is what it is.
Right. So generally,
I get a bit salty sometimes, you know, when I feel like I've got a point to make across and someone's coming out as just being extremely insensitive or sometimes idiotic. So you get that, you know. Facebook, social media generally is a place where you don't need a degree or any kind of qualification to get on, or any kind of training, or it's very unfiltered. So you have to deal with, unfortunately, all kinds of people. And sometimes it calls for you to be a bit hard on people and harsh on people just to get a point across, especially when you're in a didactic mode. We don't have a very
cultured audience.
Yes, that's the word. Not a very cultured audience sometimes. And you're dealing with, you know, people that are used to the argument of force. And sometimes you have to kind of play that game, you know, to get into their minds and tell them what they need to hear. Yeah. So I guess that's where the name Arrogant comes from.
I think it's interesting what you're sharing, because somehow I believe that in a way you need to have a level of arrogance to succeed, which I think that I've experienced basically in my life. I mean, arrogance in court, in the sense of sometimes you don't have to care about what a lot of people think, and then there's a lot of the gods feeling, there's a lot of having to summon that inner confidence for you to succeed at things. And I wonder if that is also part of your personality, and I'm trying to just mix that alongside with the things that you have been able to achieve. Does that also link to part of your personality and how you chase things?
Yeah, you're right. You know, you make a valid point. I wouldn't really call it arrogance. I'll call it self-confidence.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have an awful lot of self-confidence to be able to move against the grain sometimes, you know. I'm not one that is scared to hold and push my opinion, even if the popular trend is going, you know, the opposite way. And so, yes, you're right that you do need a healthy amount of self-confidence, you know, to kind of be a leader among people. I made a statement once on Facebook that, you know, never underestimate the power of foolish people in large groups.
I have to come to that. Very interesting.
And And you know, that's what you're really standing up against when you're a step ahead of the game, when you're, you know, avant-garde, when you're ahead of your time. So you know, people are always like, okay, they can't figure it out, and they always want to, and they can, people can be very arrogant. You know, arrogance is part of the Cameroon culture. It's a very peculiar culture in Cameroon, but it is part of it. And the one thing that I have, you know, that I have learned in Cameroon is that if you really want to lead Cameroonians, if you want to like show a way, you know, that how things are supposed to be done, then sometimes you have that arrogance culture. But you know, coming from where you are, if you come from a place of experience, you come in a place of, you know, you've traveled several countries, you've seen how things work, you've done things before, and you've seen the outcome, you know, then it's more of just confidence in yourself. And I was speaking with a friend of mine, you know, actually, I think he won Entrepreneur of the Year at this year's some awards as well. Dr. Leslie Azonwara, he's the Director General of Avians PLC, this payment solution. Yes. And he was sharing with me that in most developed cultures, you know, you relate with people as a leader, you reason with them, you talk with them. Yeah. But in the Cameroon culture, you almost have to talk down on people to be taken seriously. If you ever led a group of Cameroonians, people do not take you seriously when you try to relate, you try to be friends with them. You know, a simple example, if I'm in South Africa or in the United States, my mate, you know, is like part of the family. So we understand ourselves. It's not our rules, you know. She comes and goes in as she pleases. We talk, we discuss issues. In Cameroon, once you let your maid into your dining room, she loses a sense of her position. Exactly, a sense of perspective, you know. Which means that to maintain any kind of control over your environment, you almost have to be looked down on it and talked down on it. Which is why you will see in Cameroon, like in some other countries, you know, to a certain extent, a doctor should be called doctor this, not by their first name.
In the West, and then we have that as well for us in journalism. So exactly. Like even when I studied in UB, you wouldn't say Mr. Ari. It's like Ari. We call all of our people like exactly. By their name.
And that's a really reasonable way to go about things, because at the end of the day, you know, like we're just human beings, you know, we're coming to this thing and we're trying to figure things out, and we're and you know, everybody has got something to put on the table. Everybody's got something to contribute. You know, everybody's bringing something, you know, to the communal part that we share. But unfortunately, we live in a culture where people kind of, you know, gauge you and size you, and try to develop an order of things that they want to respect or not. Yeah.
It's interesting that you share that. There's something I wrote back, I think it's about a year ago, and I said, people, and I read this from Socrates, people are consistently inconsistent with themselves. And that happens a lot, even with social media. One time, Stanley says something, everybody's like, King Kong, King Kong. The other moment, a video pops up from 3 years ago. Everybody's just like, Blackleg, he sold out, he's doing this. And I'm like, this is the same thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I have to agree. I always say that when you're working you're used to working with people and working with you know, public, you know, as a public figure, people kind of look at you each time. And I always tell public figures, there is nothing that can go too wrong or nothing that can go too right. You know, people are what they are. Today you're a hero, tomorrow you're zero. Today you're zero, tomorrow you're a hero. It's just like the public brain is very difficult to comprehend, and it's very illogical in a sense. There's no consistent train of thought that says, okay, this person is this, so therefore he stays, this is who he is, this is his, almost like his reputation. You know, it's never established, really. It just depends on, oh, you do one charitable deed, and yes, you're this, or you do, and I know you're that. And I think it comes from over-reliance on you know, dopamine and all of those hormones that we see when we go online, and, you know, we get a like, or we get this, or we get this reaction. We want to see what's the news, and that we kind of rely on those hormones that flow in our, you know, in us. And then we form we form a communal opinion for that moment. When you're a person that thinks like that, you know, you easily get to be, you could easily get ostracized. You can easily get, you know, you can easily be labeled arrogant in some cases, you know, because I follow some blogs like Poise Social.
Xenophon.
I think very, Tino Foy, they have very in-depth analysis of situations and very reasonable, very well thought out, very well articulated. But you always find that they're not always on the popular side of, you know, things. Because that is consistency, I think. So it's interesting that you brought that up. Yeah.
Right. I'd like to go a lot into most of your journey. I think one of the, and by the way, one of my favorite song from you is The Power of a Woman, which I think I've listened to at this point more than 1,000 times. Okay. I send that to my girl. I said, hey, look, you need to pray for me. If you pray for me, I'm going to make up. But I wanted to, it's interesting that we've already got into the conversation. But usually we'll start up the podcast by really asking, how do you feel about yourself in this current phase of your life? What would you say to that question?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And interestingly, it takes some thought. How do I feel myself this moment? I guess comfortable. You know, I used to worry about very many things. I don't worry about so many things nowadays. Very little bothers me. You know, I cherish family a lot right now. You know, my wife, my son. You know, it's the, I see all the beauty of the world, you know, in them. And I feel a kind of sense of accountability, you know, to myself. Mm-hmm. You know, as a person, I've made a lot of mistakes in my life. I've done, you know, like countless mistakes I've made, you know, and there was a point where, you know, I think my life has been in phases. There's a point where you think everything's easy because you can basically do anything. You've got that youthful exuberance and you've got all of these things, you know. And then at a certain stage, you realize that, oh, you didn't really maximize all the things that, you know, that you had. And then it comes a saying of, okay, what if? And then you start blaming yourself. And then at a certain point, you realize that, you know, you're growing through all of those things that you've achieved so much in terms of, like, personally. You see the person that you've become and you're like, wow. You know, and that's the point where the comfort sits in, where you're no longer scared of what people think. You're no longer scared of, you know, of the future because you know who you are. And you just worry about the challenge of today. You don't worry about tomorrow, you know. You've made enough mistakes and learned enough from those mistakes to know that whatever tomorrow brings, you can deal with. And then, you know, you start to cherish the things that really matter, you know, which is, I think, in that sense, you know, comes down to family. And that's really it. I mean, I hardly do interviews now. In the past, I got a rush, you know, like an adrenaline rush, and I had an interview. And I had to talk to people, and I was like, yeah, it doesn't excite me. Like, I'm not trying to prove anything to anybody. And I'm probably my most creative space right now musically than I have. I create a lot of music now. I don't even want rush to put it out. I just feel happy doing it. Yeah, so the sense of comfort, fulfillment, and it's just exciting that I know, you know, what really matters to me now. And I always say, I work with a lot of young people. I say, like, you know, in 10 years time you're going to learn this, so don't rush about it, you know. I kind of feel, you know, yeah. And what is exciting is that at the same time, every day I'm learning, you know, because I kind of learned from experience that in 5 years' time, I'm looking at myself, 5 years, I'm like, damn. But I must say I'm a late bloomer in a way. You know, I went to school very early, and a lot of people feel like, okay, I got things very early. Yes, I did, actually. You know, but there's one thing, you know, my most prized position right now is my personal development. You know, I could give so much to the world, but, you know, I think the point for me when I started to be, you know, to become a man for me is when I started to understand myself, you know, and look after myself, and which was not very long ago. So yeah, that has been the price for me, and I think it's where my greatest sense of fulfillment comes from. Yeah,
I like what you're sharing, because I think that was one of the whole essence of me trying to have an interview with you. And because I believe that a lot of times when you guys go out on interviews, everybody is asking, oh, so how much do you charge now for a show? Or this, what's your motivation and all that? And I felt like I wanted to have more of a deeper conversation to understand the person behind works there. because I also think that that's really, really important. It's interesting that you talk about personal development. And even for me, when I started to put lots of things in place for my life, be it from, I mean, right down to the simplest things as my spending, my sleep, like the places where I go, the things I say no to, the things that I say yes to. And then I realized that I became a more stable person. And then that way affected my relationship, it affected my family and every other thing that I had.
Yeah.
One of the things I believe is to be able to understand somebody, it's important to also understand how they grow up. So I'm curious, how did you grow up? And I'm also very curious where the moment was for you, where you went. Now I have to get into music business.
You know, I grew up in, I would say, in a very modest family. I was exposed to music at a very young age. My dad, you know, is very musical. Like, he taught me how to play the guitar. So, you know, I think that interest really came from him. And we used to grow up, we had, you know, these VHS tapes that we would play. There was this particular one, the Motown sound, which was 25 years, you know, celebration of Motown history. We used to play that tape. And every time the deck got dirty, we'd use that tape to clean it up. We'd play it and it's going to clean it up. That particular, I don't know why. That one always cleaned the tape because the deck used to get dirty and that particular tape would clean it up. So we grew up on that sound. So the sound of, you know, the Four Tops and the Temptations, Lena Rothstadt, Marvin Gaye, the Jackson 5, Diana Ross, so I think that really spurred my interest in music a lot. The sad thing about it is that at the same time, you know, since I was very young, it kind of skewed my vision of music and what I thought about music. I was never really exposed to African music a lot. Mm-hmm. I went to boarding school at a very early age. So leaving from boarding school, coming back, you know, and then leaving for South Africa, still very young, and all of that. Only very much later did I really start to understand the rhythms and the beauty of African music. And so that kind of impacted a lot of my early sound. Much later, you know, messing with music by Bob Marley, Ari Dikonge, and as a guitarist, it kind of influenced my acoustic sound. If you listen to my first compositions, which is where my music was really based, that soulful acoustic sound. That was it for me. But I knew then, you know, and it's not something I really pursued intentionally that much. But I think when I went to study in South Africa, I had to look for, you know, source of income to maintain myself. And that is when I started to do shows like singing at birthday parties and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then through, you know, meeting people, I got invited to a festival. I think the Durban Festival. I can't remember Durban Beach Festival. Yeah, organized by Dan Chioboli. And there I met, you know, like some really important established musicians like Jito Baloyi and them from Tananas, who, you know, kind of took interest in me and showed me the ropes in, you know, getting to see
young people. So you're staff music?
No, I don't have staff music. I play by ear. Getting to work with those musicians, like with, you know, established jazz musicians, especially, you know, like really, really pushed me. In fact, Jito Baloyi, rest in peace, was my very first producer. And it's after he passed, I thought, oh, let me start producing myself. Because I was South African, you know, there was really, I mean, who was I going to work with, you know, like at the time? So I had to start by myself and then, you know, things kind of kicked up from there.
Interesting, because that was, for me, I play by ear, so I kind of grew up in a music family and then started learning how to play the keyboard, then the bass, and then I bought my own instrument. But if you just put stuff music in front of me, I'm like zero, but just give me and I'll replicate. When was the transition for you from just being an artist to the music business itself?
2010 actually. It was 2010, yeah. I used to get a lot of airplay on the urban channel TV stations in South Africa. So Channel O, Trace, MTV, yeah. And I remember, you know, I would go out to shows, you know, like we did the 2010 Africa Day with Dibanj and Yvonne Shaka Shaka. Like, I think the headliners were myself, Dibanj, Yvonne Shaka Shaka, WHP, and some lady from Gabon, I can't remember her name. And then DJ Waxy was a DJ, you know. and we'll go on to these shows, and Waxy will be like, hey, Wax, he'll come like, hey, Wax, I never see a handle, you know, like what Jess would say, you know, and then he'll be like, you know, we have a problem with Cameroonian music because wherever we go out to do shows, Cameroonians don't turn up. Go to any country, bring an artist from, pull out a country from any art, an artist from any country, and they pull up. But it was like Cameroon in particular, we had a reputation at that stage for not just having a presence when the artists were coming out. And it's like, something is wrong with your country. So it got me really thinking, you know. At the same time, at that time, I started to understand that there was a problem with building the structure in Cameroon. And as a Cameroonian, you know, I had a lot more work to do than just, you know, singing, you know. And then at the same time, I studied law. So having to work with all these artists, I quickly found out that, especially the Nigerians, whenever there was a contract, I'll be the first person to call. So God forbid, hey, Wax, there's this person is coming in, that Flavor is coming in. You know, I found myself in the middle of contracts, even to the point of, you know, actually negotiating Flavor's first release in South Africa, out of Nigeria, the Noir Baby album with Universal Music, you know, under my label. And then, you know, then there was a World Cup song that came out with Shakira, you know, and obviously I knew the song was from Cameroon, Golden Sound, Zangalewa. And you know, I'm sitting there and this song's coming up. I knew it was coming up. So I called back in Cameroon, hey, do you guys know that Shakira is remaking this song? Nobody knows about it. I was like, what? So nobody's been contacted about this. And understanding the law and understanding, the, you know, like everything I've been going, you know, about just getting my rights together. So I knew that something was wrong, that something I've done about it. So I put myself in that position and ended up being the person that was, you know, working for Zanga, Golden Sound when the song came out, you know, to bring, you know, to negotiate a settlement for them, which went very well, by the way.
Yeah, something that I read. I read that. I don't know if this is true, but I read that Shakira had to give the group about $400,000, which is approximately $260,000.
That was advanced settlement. But it's,
how much was that?
It's a much more substantial fee than that. That was an advance, so it was about $250 for the, because it was a master that was used. It was $250 for the royalties and $150, I think, for the master, right? That was in the song. That was an advance. I mean, the basis, look, guys, for the past 10 years, the group has been receiving checks every 3 months from the song. Yeah, and they still receive it today. So, and the three main writers, Dogi, Emil Kojidi, and Zay Bellamy, so rest in peace. Yeah, they get their checks every 3 months. And I mean, and it's a lot of money. It runs into millions every 3 months that each of them receive. So it's been a lot of money for more than 13 years running. So it's a substantial amount of money that they've made from it, but that's where I found myself. You know, being exposed to a big industry at the time, being in the position where as an artist among the other artists, I was just more informed. I had actually taken the time to go out and look at what it means to have these rights, and then realizing that back when I came from, nothing really existed like that. Recently, I think you know, people are waking up to the reality that administration is part of the music business. Now it's much easier for you know, like the Western markets, because the structures have been put in place and people are running all of those things, and you know, and it's a big business for them, especially for the white people. In our case, yeah, we kind of just trying to wing it, and yeah, but
now I kind of have two questions to ask you at this point. The first is, which is like a straight off answer.
Mm-hmm.
Can an artist make a lot of money from music without necessarily having a lot of following? And when I talk about a lot of following, maybe let's put a cap to it. Like, let's have about 5,000 followers, where maybe you have about 500 to 1,000, or let's say 500 to 5,000 staunch listeners. Is there the possibility of making a living from that artistry at that point? And then the second question, obviously, is just which you talked about earlier on your social media. You said artists should consider using both independently owned platforms as well as the general streaming platforms that are out there so they can maximize their earnings. So I wanted to just ask you about that. First, if artists can make money independently from...
The questions are a bit linked. I think that if you have, you know, if you have 5,000 staunch followers, it's very possible to make a living out of that. If you have 5,000 staunch followers, especially if those followers are found in one place, you know, because it gives you a lot of possibilities, you know. Say you have 5,000 followers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of those followers, you know, that you call fans, 500 of them are willing to pay a subscription fee of $10 a month.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Platform. So it'd be like, okay, I have 5,000 followers in this, you know, and I communicate massively with them and tell them, look, I need your support for my music career. I need you to subscribe at a rate of 5,000 francs a month for me, so you can get exclusive songs, exclusive music, and give my content and all of that. You know, you get everything I got. You get first-hand information, you get freebies, you get birthday shout-outs, you get whatever. Blah, 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 blah. Exactly. You're looking at 5 million francs a month.
Ooh.
It sounds simple, but it's because it's that simple.
What's up, guys? If you're watching this, I just wanted to break here to give you some important news. So we have just launched the Smart Club, which is my private mentorship club for anyone who wants to learn a high-income digital marketing skill. Whether you're building your personal brand, whether you want to become a freelancer, a service provider, or your goal is to learn the skill and get a high-income digital marketing job, the Smart Club is the place for you. We have 12-plus digital marketing skills that we're going to teach you through live classes. So every week for the next couple of months, I'm literally going to mentor you personally and make sure that you reach your goal with your digital marketing skills. So down below, I just wanted to break and give you a very quick shout-out. Down below, there's going to be a link. Make sure you check it and enroll before you keep watching the rest of the video. And I look forward to seeing you on your very first club session.
So, on OnlyFans, you know, ladies are making millions from showing their bodies, right? For example, they're able to do that. So why can artists not do that if they have a following?
Yeah. Mm.
So that's the whole point. It's very possible. It's not only possible, it's actually practical. It's doable. And that's why, think of it this way. When you do a concert, there's this odd guy that comes and farates you 100,000, 200,000. But he's not going to buy your song.
Yeah, true.
So the fans want to spend on you, but you have to convince them that it's worth their while.
And create those avenues, yes.
Exactly. And then they shouldn't feel cheated, you know, because if you're telling somebody buy a song that is free, it feels like you're trying to pull a fast one on him. But if you bring something that is exclusive, bring a merchandise, I can offer you this, a birthday shout, I can give you this, I can offer you this, you know, you get a free this. All of a sudden, you know, this guy is like, okay, let me encourage my artists. That's why I believe that artists should not just rely on streaming services. If you're in the US, which pays handsomely well, in Cameroon it's even worse, much worse. If you do 1 million streams on Spotify, you get $4,000.
One million streams.
YouTube might give you $5,000 or something like that. I can't remember how much it is, or 6,000 or 7,000, maybe 8,000. I'm not sure. You know, for a million streams, right? In the right market, not in Cameroon. Now, if you're selling a song for 1,000 francs, you only need to sell to 2,000 people to make that 2 million francs. On your platform. Okay, and the interesting thing is that, you know, when it comes to your fans, you know, you don't have to sell for 1,000 francs. So on my website, for example, if I really need to push a product, like everything I sell on my platform is pay at your own price, right? Mm. So I get people go there and buy a product for $200, buy a song for $200 because they want to support me. Because I've asked them, hey, I'm pushing this, I need your assistance, or this, you know, this is my dad, you know. Sometimes I do, you know, like heavy marketing to a select, you know, group of VIP fans. I'm like, I'm pushing this new product, it's coming on this, da da da, da. You can pre-order. People will go there and like $100, $50, $200 and buy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many streams I need to get in Cameroon to make that money? So when you're I really think it makes logical sense for every artist to push it on private platforms as well. Because that's your money and that's your show money. And it almost a way to connect and satisfy your fans, you know, that those stream platforms are not going to give you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is, apart from just creating the music and relying on the streams from it, you as an artist, it is your responsibility to go out there and create those avenues where your fans can give you that money, not necessarily by streaming, because the music is kind of considered they can get it free elsewhere.
Exactly. You have to. Yeah.
You talk like that, I kind of think about something which I did earlier on. There's a time I got featured once, I think I was 2019, got on the BBC, had a bit of buzz. And I came back, took out a book. And then in the process of selling the book, so I was selling the book at 5,000 francs. And then I realized that I actually had a lot of people because it was around social media, which is my thing. I was like, I have to build relationships on social media. But I realized that I will always break even. For example, I would spend, for my numbers, every time I spend 4,000 francs, I sold one copy of a book, and a copy of the book sells at 5,000. So I was like, how do I maximize profits at the back end of it? So I went behind and I created a consultancy session with myself, 1 hour consultancy for 107,000. And it simply said, once you buy the book, I build the funnel, it takes you to the next page. And it says, hey, thank you for buying this book on how to make money, build relationships, social media. Now I know that you're in the process of building your business and I wanted to offer you, would you like to have a 1 hour session with me where I break down and I look at your marketing and I see what you're doing right or what you're not doing right. This is going to cost 107,000 francs. Let's say for every 50 persons that bought the book, I got just one or two of the people to take on my consultancy. I realized that I kind of made way more money at the back end. And at the end of it, quite honestly, I generated more than 5 to 7 million selling that. And then people were like, oh, I already wrote his book and he's just promoting it like that. But from the back end, the 107,000 consultancy was paying for everything.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's a business model that, you know, as artists, people need, we need to get comfortable with it. That, you know, there's so many opportunities in business when you have clientele, people that believe in you and people that follow you. And your role as a business person is to satisfy their need. And their needs is limited to what you can provide or what you think, what you, the product you have in front of you. There's so much more. I mean, like, artists are selling birthday wishes on websites. Artists are selling, and people can pay for these things. People will pay for them. So why not use them? You know, as a person, I wear many hats, you know. And the funny thing is that I never say something that I've not done on social media. Yeah. Whatever I'm saying, something I've done, I've tried it out. I'm like, okay, this thing works. So these things, they wouldn't make me rich. They could make me rich if I put more structure to them.
I mean, you're already rich.
One thing I know for sure is that, you know, they pay the bills.
I want to ask you something, which is, I call it a 1 billion story, talking about birthday wishes. And in 2021, I think it's 2022, you posted something that blew off my mind. And I'm not sure you even remember, but I sat down, I read that post about 5 times because I was trying to think about your thought process when you wrote that. And you talked about the time when you signed it. In 2021, you signed Shura. And then in 2022, she's writing, she's doing her album called Prime. And then from Primed, you select the Happy Birthday song, which you called it the money bit, right? I'm saying because I remember reading that and how you said it. And then the idea is, because Orange Cameroon has 10 million clients, the idea is that you're going to sell it to them, sell a song to them and say, or license a song to them and say, okay, if you're wishing your clients happy birthday, it's going to cost about 100 francs for each client, which is a billion francs. However, you choose to give them, I think that was, you said, 1,000% off, which was them giving you a one-off fee of 100 million francs, right? Yeah. And two things really struck me when I read that. The first thing is that you thought about the opportunity that Camtel was launching Blue, and you came up with a plan to propose to Orange, which that was the first thing. And the second thing, I was like, that's genius, because it's about you seeing the opportunity and then going, okay, another person will look at Camtel launching Blue and want to go and pitch Camtel. But you took
I went
to pitch Orange. So talk to me about, what was your thought process at that point? We'll come to the figures, but what was your thought process around you seeing that opportunity?
You know, one thing I've learned is life is about strategy, right? So I'm always looking at the big picture. And if you notice something, you know, sometimes we lose not because we're doing badly, but because other people are doing better, right? And sometimes you win not because you're doing well, but because other people are doing worse. So we live in an environment that is constantly mobile. And you know, if you're an artist, you will know, for example, that if you're not doing anything, you're losing. You cannot maintain by maintaining. You can only maintain by pushing upward, because other people are pushing upward, you know. And so if you stay at the same spot, you lose your spot. So I kind of think in that light, you know, I'm thinking like, okay, I'm always thinking, how do I relate to other people? And at every point, I think, what's my comparative advantage over other people? Because that's all you have, your comparative advantage. So there's a new, you know, my age group, they figured us out as musicians. In the past, when they saw you on TV, like, wow, he's on TV. Ooh, they get all excited. Now they don't like, TV. They know that TV means nothing. TV is just flash, right? And what matters is what's going to your bank account. All right. The young guys in university and secondary school do not yet know that.
Yeah, they want the boss.
Yes. They still think that TV is giving you cash. You know all that, right? So, for example, if I'm marketing to my age group, I can't go and market them. Yes, I just did this. I was on this plan. No, I can't tell them that. I have to show them moves.
Right? The figures.
Exactly. You have to show them moves and figures. You have to give them something that is unattainable for them. Like, for example, if you're meeting with Donald Trump.
Right. Trump Tower.
Yeah, like if you're in Trump Tower, you're going to the Senate to do something that is like exciting to them. Like, okay, this is something that money cannot buy. Because now we can afford to wear those clothes that he was wearing. We can afford, you know, to do, but you're talking to those young people down there, it's a whole different story. But here's the thing. The language I've spoken by those young people down there is completely different from our language right now. And we might be speaking the same English or the same pidgin, but the nuances are different and the mannerisms are different. Because it's their circle and they understand themselves. That is why the young people on social media are killing it and making more than the older people, right? So I'm always having to think now, what's my comparative advantage? What is it that I can have to impress those people that their friends do not have, right? And in my own circle, what is it that I have that they do not have? And that's how I have to structure myself. So you have to constantly, you know, kind of size yourself based on, you know, your comparative advantage and move.
And if we break it down to someone who is watching right now, because I want to make sure this is also very helpful. Let's say a young artist or someone in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
What's their comparative advantage? What I used to think, and let me just tell you, I think that's very important right now for any artist growing up to build an email list, because I'm a huge, huge fan of that. When I started building my email list back, 4 years ago or something, had no clue what I was building. But one point, because I got a little into politics, I got kicked out, lost my accounts, lost all my following and everything. I simply got back on Facebook, sent an email, one single email. Hey guys, I'm back. And the email list, quite honestly, it pumps me cash when I want to create my digital product. So let's talk about someone who's watching this now. What is an artist or an entertainer's comparative advantage? You looking at the market and you being someone who is in the trenches.
I think everybody knows, you know, what they have to offer the others or not, right? You know, because one thing I've learned is that you have a gut feeling when you know what in the past gives you your money, right? You know where you've earned your most money. You know the thing that you've done with the most ease, right? You know that one thing that you've done that others cannot do with the same level of, you know, the same level of professionalism, with the same level of ease as you do. It's a thing that's in your gut. And a lot of the conflict that we have with ourselves that we try to deny those things. I'm a good talker, right? I can talk people into doing things. So I know that, okay, for example, if there's a deal to be made, I can go to an office and talk people into doing it and convince people to doing it, right? And get what I want and go out. Am I as good a singer as Loco? No. I can't sing as much as Loco. Loco's comparative advantage is his voice.
Ooh, yeah.
You know? So all he has to do is to keep singing as much as possible.
So you're playing to your strength.
Exactly. You know? The one thing that I will not do, that I discourage people from doing, is try to sell to a market that is not listening to you. Because then you come up as being you come up as being unsure of yourself, as being, you know, you just come up as being funny, you know, and looking stupid. Yeah. Everybody knows, I think, you know, what that is, you know. So, yeah.
The numbers, 100 France times 10 million clients, that's 1 billion. And then giving them a 1,000% slash, bringing that down to 100 million. Is that, do we have that much money in music?
Yes, we do. Of course, we do have that much money in music. Yes, we do have that much money in music. So music money is crazy money.
Ooh.
Music money is crazy money. Like, you have no idea how much money there is in music. So every time you hear a ringtone on MTN or Orange, it's being paid for by the client. MTN charges that user 100 francs, like, for that ringtone, right? 10 million subscribers with ringtones every month. That's a lot of money. That's on one platform. Every time music is being used, money is changing hands. Every time music is being downloaded, money is being used. So you cannot tell me that there's not a lot of money in music. There's a crazy, insane amount of money in music. Yeah. And the figures just made sense. When I sent the mail to Orange, we were very excited. They were so excited, it was crazy. Like, the call for missing the next day. I had to leave the island and go to Douala. Sat down and had a 3-hour working session, like, okay, we want this, let's do this, operationalize it. It was all good. I don't know what went bad with the deal. I suspect, after some retrospection, that the artist went behind. Because she never complained.
Ooh.
I kind of gave it some time. 1 year after, she had not come and asked me, Wax, what happened to the deal? So I was like, okay, did you go back to speak to the people? And, you know, everything got, and, you know, and then things got sour at some point. Because anybody in their right mind, she was in the meeting. We sat and negotiated everything together. She would have come back to me 2 weeks and said, Wax, I've not heard back from Orange. She's never done it. So I can say with 85% certainty that she went back and tried to deal with them on her own.
Do you still work with her at this point? I know you talked about 1 year deal.
No, I don't. In 2015, in South Africa, Runtown was in town in Johannesburg. So I called him up. We went to a studio and did a song called Viva Mandela. He recorded the first verse. It's online. I sent it to Banky W. The next day, he sent me a verse. Then he had this artist that was signed to him. I can't remember the name. There's one other artist that, yeah, left him, yeah, but was with him at the time that Whiskey was signed to him. And then I got Casper Nyovest from South Africa. It took a bit longer, but in 2 weeks, he sent me the verse. We did a song called Viva Mandela. As long as I done a Mandela song, in the song of Nelson Mandela, right? And when I went to see the downloads on MTN for Cola Tunes, he was making about $40,000 a month.
Ooh. Just MTN alone. That's not bad. Not other streamings. Forget shows. Forget just MTN.
Downloads. Tribute songs to Mandela. Everybody wanted a Mandela song behind on their thing. Google her songs Mandela. You'll see it.
Oh my God.
So I told the guys, like, okay, I want us to do, it was 3 songs since that song was done. People are tired of that song. Let's do another one and do the same thing. But this time we'll get more star power around it and put it on MTN again and say, we've done a new one. At the time our songs did that song, Mandela was alive. It was for his birthday. Now Mandela died. So, okay, let's do one for Mandela's death celebration too, as a, you know. And the advantage is that when people are talking about Mandela's death, they'll download that song. When they talk about his birthday, they'll download that song. So we did a song. It's called Viva Mandela. It's online. Go check it. And we did the song, said on MTN. Within a month, we had 10 million downloads.
10 million.
Yeah. Now, do the math. Right, that was the month, and The song's still getting downloaded to now, because sometimes I call phones in South and I hear the collection we're playing. So it's still making money. Right? So,
wow.
If you think now with streaming platforms, if you get 1 million streams, you make $4,000. That's from the sales of another. So if you get 1 million streams on Spotify, as some artists are making, you get what? I mean, you make 1 billion streams is 4,000 times. It's $4 million. Of one song.
How do you even get there?
Jerusalem, yeah. One song. Yeah. Probably running into like $20 million.
$25 million.
Yeah. One song. So the music has a lot of money, and I think that our lack of comprehension of the business and the structure and the industry has made it such that we've belittled it in Cameroon and belittled artists.
Wax, why don't you do? I'm curious, like this, because you're talking. I just see a lot of prospects around it, and then I totally know that when I talk to friends, I feel like they're empty. But why do people not search this knowledge? And why don't you have things like masterclass? Maybe if it's an annual masterclass where you have about 500,000 of these people sit down and literally see the basics of this.
It's a good question.
Because I'm blown away.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, Nigerians have understood it. And give it up to them. They've understood. When you look at Spiral with one hit song, you know, buying G-Wagons and that, it's not a fluke. He's earning it. Because he knows that, you know, when he looks at his check, you know, what he's making, you know, from his music. It's crazy. Couple that with Tyler just blew up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know Calabash.
I heard you talk about a $2 million deal.
Yes, Calabash works as a booking agency. And I get to do with a lot of figures, right? Tyler turned down the $100,000 for a 35-minute performance this December that Calabash brought to her.
Ooh.
Yes, $100,000 for 35 playback performance. She's tired.
Was it just tiredness or was something else?
Well, she's tired. What do you know if I would?
Ooh.
She has one hit song. Placed at the right level with the right structure. You know? So, if you see anybody that turns down $100,000 for an hour of time, is making good money. It's making good money. The question for us is that how do we get there? You know?
Big question.
How do we get there? I've tried to kind of create those linkages, you know, try to build towards that slowly. And it's not quite working. You know, I took all the way down South Africa to try to, you know, work towards that, to build that. And it is what it is. I'm trying again, you know, in January, I'm taking a new artist. We're starting again from scratch.
Right. Just before we run off with the idea of music publishing, which I think we may stay, maybe there's a last question on that. But looking at the music space, one of the things I found out, which I want you to at least talk a bit about and also clarify me, because I'm just looking at it from an outside perspective. I feel like a lot of artists know when they are making commercial songs and when they are making songs from the heart. And this interplays with their career, as in there is a time for a commercial song, then there is a time for example, let's look at Mr. Leo. If I look at Mr. Leo's career, I would say that JJ was like a song from his soul, something that he wanted to bring out. But if I look at Enva Jire, I know that was the commercial audience he was trying to talk to. How do you, what would you have to say about this, and how do you think artists can manage this better time?
I think it's really a personal choice. You know? It's really a personal choice. Music at the end of the day is a business. And if Ombajoy pays the bills, then it is what it is. Yeah. It's about strategy. I wouldn't say either is better. You know, it depends on what you define for yourself as success. Yeah. So for some people, commercial success is success. For other people, being able to tell their story in the way that they, in its truest art form is their success. One thing for sure, I know that as a performer, Mr. Leo shines performing Jai Jai more than he'll ever shine performing Ombajiri. And perhaps that, you know, as a person, Jai Jai will take him in 20, 30 years' time. You're more relevant than Ombajiri. But it's that, you know, it's hard to tell which one really works better for who at the end of the day, because you don't want to know as an artist that, you know, died of hunger. I mean, and there are lots of artists that have died of hunger, and then 30 years down the line, their music has, you know, made millions and billions for their families. Yeah. So we should always feel blessed that we have that creative force among us, and that we're able to enjoy such great music. Yeah. Right. For the rest, it's a personal decision between the artist and their labels and what their objectives are. Yeah, but it is what it is. Right.
You talked about, you came under fire a couple of weeks back when you said that the South African music industry is more, I want to read your exact words, more valuable than the Nigerian music industry.
Yeah.
What was the metrics for that, and what was the thought process behind you making that statement?
I've operated in both the South and Nigerian music industries, right? And Nigeria is making a huge buzz. And, you know, I got a lot of flack from Nigerians for making that post. I don't know why they are very nationalistic, but human beings are what they are, you know. In the past, I've been very positive. I've always been very positive about Nigerian music. And I'm very defensive of their music and their artists. And the necessity was to collaborate more with them and defending that we do need Nigerian music in Cameroon while still advocating for 80-20, you know, because 80-20 doesn't mean that banning foreign music or, you know, it's just a different concept. It's just been misconstrued.
Are you a fan of the 80-20?
There's nothing like a fan of 80-20. 80-20 is not a star, right? 80-20 was not started by anybody in particular. It's been running. It's an ideology and coming and running in Cameroon for quite a while. So, to say that 820 was started by a certain individual who has no clue, you know, how the music industry operates, and who in many ways is instigating, you know, hate and, you know, and just negative sentiments among the people is very fallacious. But while being neutral and while being appreciative of the value of Nigerian music, you know, in terms of ensuring that we remain competitive, I also have to be, you know, I was just trying to get people to appreciate the South African culture, which is a culture that is very steeped in music, like it's very culturally deep, you know, and it came from mostly Nigerians saying that they made Amapiano popular and that, you know, South Africans don't actually sing, you know, and there's no doubt that South Africa has better singers than Nigerians, you know, South Africa is just made up of singers, you know, it's their culture. Singing in South Africa, it comes from appetite. Right? When people are happy, they sing. When they're dancing, they sing. When they're going to war, they sing. When they're partying, they sing. When they're working, they sing. You know, all the housemates are singers. Everybody in South Africa is a singer, literally. You know? And they have really lyrical and melodious music. If you listen to, like, the contemporary soul music. But also very varied music. So from jazz to contemporary pop music to soul music to makanga, which is their different traditional kinds of music, to house music where they're the world leaders, to rock music, to hip hop, you know, to where their rappers are extremely successful. You know, if you compare, you can't really compare South African rappers, Casper Nyovest, Nasty C, AK, who passed away. They are the wealthiest rappers on the continent, you know. And then now there's just this rhetoric that's going on that Nigerians made Amapiano popular. The truth is that Amapiano is by itself, it's a really popular brand of music. Right? And my point was that you need to look at the history of Amapiano to see where it comes from, the depth that it has, So understand that those noises that you see start coming on are not just empty noises. There's a history behind it. There's a culture behind it. It's like when you go to someone and look at his juju dance and you're criticizing it because it doesn't sound like your hip hop, right? That's a culture for them. And I remember when it was made popular by South Africans dancing on TikTok.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that there's nothing that beats a South African girl dancing to Amapiano on TikTok. There is nothing that beats that. There's no amount of popularity that you can get. And these are not stars. These are just normal girls who are raking up millions and billions of views on TikTok by just dancing Amapiano. And that's how the dance moved, you know, and became, you know, really intended international. And the fact that, yes, Nigerians are now playing it, but you get on every stage. You know, you get on every stage, international stages. You see all this whole Amapiano stage. It's a big thing in Europe right now, which is made up of the names I don't even know, but they are there, touring internationally. Mm-hmm. Huge movement. So Nigerians, like, have just come on it, yes, and they're making one or two Amapiano hits. And if you think about, like, as somebody that's in the music industry, I see Amapiano in its 11th or 12th generation already. So the dance has evolved. But because Nigerians don't have a sufficient understanding, which is understandable because it's not their culture, they're stuck in, you know, the old Amapiano, and then they're like, yeah, this. But the thing is evolving. It's a whole thing it's a movement that is going far, right? Mm. How then do you explain to people that, look, this thing is deeper than you think. It's not just what you're seeing on the surface. You're just scratching the surface. It's a whole deep thing.
So the basics of your rating then was more of the, because you made a statement, you said, the entire system benefits from what was happening in the industry, the DJs and everything.
Yeah, the basis of my rating was that South Africa has a better structure, it's more structured, and then and the music economy is bigger. So South Africa has a more vibrant musical scene. There's lots more shows happening, there's lots more everything when it comes to that. So statistically, according to PricewaterhouseCoopers, South Africa is more valuable than Nigeria.
Mm.
You know, it's a conversation that can be extrapolated. Look at South African film, for example, and this is just me being straightforward. Yeah. Now people get mad because you're like, no, Burna Boy is this. I made an example of the video of Burna Boy and Black Off, for example, because
yeah,
it was just an example to show that South Africans, the fact that they are very calm people, they're not very noisy people, but it doesn't mean that they're not killing it. Because Black Off is twice the net worth of Burna Boy.
Yeah. Really?
Google it. Go to Forbes. Go to Forbes and Google it and check it out. Right? So you have an industry like South Africa where that produces Hollywood movies. For example. Right? South Africa has world-class studio. You know, like the Avengers is a South African movie.
Really? Like, I had no clue.
South African director, South African studio.
I'm just hearing this for the first time.
Now, when you go to the economy of South African films, South African series, you know, the amount of money that is being spawned by those people, Nigeria doesn't come close. Nigeria is just big. And of course, there's noise and there's volume because Nollywood and all of that. But it's a volume of low-budget productions, right? South Africa has, you know, has the most valuable entertainment. It's not as noisy as Nigeria. These are statistical facts, right? And what is even, you know, what is even more interesting is the fact that a lot of the Nigerian platforms are owned by South Africans. So Africa Magic is a South African channel.
Right.
Yeah, African Magic is a drug. Big Brother Nigeria is a South African production.
I see.
Right? So when you look at the actual industry and the structure, Nigerians are just riding the wave that South Africa has. But they're allowed and they package and all of that. So you kind of get a false sense that this is the crux of the African industry, but it's actually not. So you can get a Burna Boy that is charging 200 million now for a show now, or David or that. What about the entire industry? Right? What about the entire industry? Like, one of the things, like, the industry is so structured in every sense. I had friends who were radio DJs in South Africa that used to work 3 hours a day from Monday to Friday. They never produced because they had a producer, they had a line editor, so they had everything. They had a team of 6 people working for their show. They never even selected music. They just came and sat there, pressed the button, and spoke for 3 hours on the radio. And, you know, at the end of the month, they'll earn 20 million francs CFA. You don't want to mess up the industry. That is, you know, that's an industry that they know what they're doing, right? And there's no way to explain to Nigerians that, yeah. How do you explain it to Nigerians that, yeah, when I get the packaging, but, you know, everybody has something to learn from somebody. Everybody has something to learn from the other person. You can learn structure from South Africa. Right? So I wasn't throwing punches at Nigeria, as people thought. I was just stating the facts. Like, these are the facts. And people take it really, really badly when you say things the way they are. Because we wanna, you know, and when you go on YouTube, you go to Google and Google, biggest industries went to Nigeria on Google, of course. This is written by blogs. Bloggers are not journalists.
Right.
Bloggers don't know and they don't care to know. A blogger would willingly publish something that's going to give them likes.
Yeah, and it's based on opinion.
They'll publish an opinion that gives them likes over a fact that does not give them likes.
In 2020, you sent a letter to President Paul Biya, and you said, young artists need to be consulted and put at the center of important decisions and structures around music in Cameroon. What was the rationale, what was the reason there for you thinking around that, and maybe how are you thinking that forward in helping Cameroonians or young Cameroonian artists?
The structure of the industry is being run by the older generation who don't have any idea about music streaming, new methods and all of that. Yeah. The young people are busy doing music, the older people are busy doing the administration. Mm-hmm. So we are in a very fortunate situation in Cameroon. It just cannot work. And I happen to be moving in those two crowds and seeing what's happening. So I felt, I knew for a fact when I wrote that, I knew that the government has eyes on me. I was given a Medal of Honor of Valor. And so they're watching me and they read what I write. Like, everything I write is read by the government, you know, and, you know, if I write something very sensitive, they're going to react. Yeah. So I kind of pick my words also very carefully. And I think that I was echoing a sentiment that those that really know the issues in Cameroon would also put forward. Now, in 2020, in July 2020, there was a law that was signed by the president, which is the 2020-011 law on regulating artistic and cultural associations in Cameroon, basically converting the sector from kickstarting a process that converts the sector from a social sector to an economic sector, and structuring, you know, the different sectors into federations, just like Africa Food. And the minister appointed me as the national coordinator for that musical art pool, which is basically the federation. And I think that ultimately, you know, we had a series of meetings with, it was not just the post, we had a series of meetings with the Ministry of Arts and Culture. At one point, I took Salasel, Daphne, Magasco, Mr. Leo, and we all went to the ministry and had a meeting there with, you know, and discussed the issue of the bridge and the gap between the young and the old people, and the fact that somehow, you know, we're going nowhere if the people that are responsible for the growth of the music right now are not being given a seat at the table. And so the fact that I'm given that role is kind of a good response to that kind of a wish from young people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's also a challenge. But the reality still remains that young people not only need to be given a seat at a table, but they also need to assume that seat.
Yeah.
Right? So we need to be more active when it comes to that. Because we have these bright ideas, we do all the great things and all of that, but we don't want to play the administrative game. Because at the end of the day, no matter how much we perform on the stage, if the structure is not right, you know, if the political economy is not right, if the policies are not in place to protect us and advance our trade, even with what is happening now, you know, we're going nowhere slowly. So I'm thinking about all of those things, you know, and yes, it's been very challenging, you know, with the musical uphold with the Federation, but it's coming to shape, you know.
In 2022, you had a brouhaha with Jovi. What's your relationship with Jovi now? I know at one point you guys, you had the talk around people being blocked in the industry, and then he responded back and forth. What's the relationship with Jovi at this point?
I really don't have a relationship with Jovi. Jovi is, and it's Mboko Gang, you know, it's just one thing that will never ever scare me in any way. Because it's something that it can really do to impact me as a person, as an artist, or as a businessman, right? And I think that's where we run it off our little tiff. But hey, like, Toyo, like, stay in your lane.
If you guys meet now, would you shake hands? Would you talk and go your way?
No, I will shake hands with anybody. I'm nobody's enemy. Right. I have no enemies. People might, if there's such a word, enemify me, but that's their business, right? I don't think I've ever said anything negative about Jovi. I've criticized him, yes. And I think in that particular circumstance, when he spoke to me rudely, I told him where to ship off, and I like don't, you know your limits. And he told them, because he came with some half-baked apology, which I was going to refuse, you know, except my team told me, like, kill it. I'm like, cool, let's kill it. But I have a lot of respect for him, right? I have a lot of respect for him, for his craft, as should be, right? It doesn't mean that if you say something stupid, I'm not going to point it out. And he does say a lot of dumb stuff. He does say a lot of dumb stuff, yeah. It might be part of his the way he reasons, the way he talks and all of that. You know, but it takes nothing away from the fact that he's a musical legend. He's an incredibly talented musician. And he has contributed a lot to the culture of Cameroon. And I think that there's still a lot that's going to come from him. It takes nothing away from that. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm cool with him. I'm cool with everybody, right? People form a lot of enemies. I'm friends with Magasco, very good friends with Magasco. Jovi talks a lot of crap about Magasco, which is okay. There's some history between them, I understand, you know, and da-da-da. Magasco might have failed, let him down, or, you know, went to sign the feedback card. But you know what? When you reach a certain level of maturity, you look past those things. You look past, you know, there's no point. If I had to come about what people do in the industry, I would be complaining everyone on Facebook, I would look like a fucking fool. Right? I remember once, on the last time I was doing an interview, somebody was like, what? There was this experience, why didn't you write about this? I'm like, no, it's not my place to write all those negative things that we're experiencing. I'm gonna stay positive, you know. Whoever feels like it's their place to do that, yes, but it's not part of my philosophy. I'm gonna get likes and engagement from it, but no. If I write anything, it has to be something objective. I might get hated for it, which is okay, but I'm still going to be objective. You know, I'm saying that, Lord, this is that, this is that. I've written very nice things about Jovi, like, wow, this guy is amazing. He did this, you know. Just like I've criticized him, and I'm never one to shy away from criticizing. If I feel like something, I want to say that, or if he's doing something that is not in the general interest of the industry, right? If it's something that is touching him and his people, I don't care. Like, that's really up to him. But if it comes up something that is just hurting the industry, I have to come and say, hey, like, it's my place to say, look, this is out of character. This is not what you should be doing.
Yeah, I think you didn't respond to his apology, did you? I don't think you responded to his apology.
I don't know if I did, but that, I think we let it die there. And as it should, there's no point dragging a dead horse, right? Yeah, but I'm just against us, really, because our social media space, we should protect it and use to protect our image, you know? And unfortunately, one thing I admire about Jovi is that he's true to his Cameroonian sound and he's patriotic.
Hmm. In closing, I want to read you something which a media personality wrote. He's called Michael Zamani. I don't know if you've heard about him. But I wanted to read it to you because I thought that it was very thoughtful, very short, 2-3 lines, very thoughtful. But I think that is a summary of who you are. It says, I would not be surprised if one day Waxley becomes the president of Cameroon. If he doesn't, Minister Nofi Passi, he's intelligent, very strategic, and creates the right connections that only takes him up. Talk all you want, but Waxley ain't your average person. And I thought that that was an exact description of you, even after talking to you now.
Wow, thank you so much. I'm really flattered. I don't like that kind of pressure, you know? I wish I could just be you. There is this, you know, people always, I always come across people who like put in me that you could be this, you could be that, but I really don't think about those things, you know. I kind of look at each day like, okay, you know, how can I make sense to people? How can I help make people feel better about themselves, act better, you know, and relate better to each other? You know, there's so many things that I can do. I can do all of them. And if I ever succeed to just, you know, impact anybody in the positive light, it brings so much joy and happiness, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I think a lot about the moves that I make. And it's a very difficult choice quite often when I make my moves, because I always find that there are so many things that my industry calls for that I don't do, because I want to keep myself in the kind of space and maintain a particular kind of image and a brand, you know, which is very difficult, you know, for me. So I'm strategic in that way. But I don't do it because I'm planning to be president or anything. I just do it because I feel like I get, it gives me a chance to maintain the faith that people have in me to be able to impact them. Yeah. I'm actually scared of power, because with power comes a lot of responsibility. So I know the weight when you have to stand up and talk and tell people and talk down to people like, this is wrong, that is right, don't do this, do that. It's a lot of weight, and you're putting yourself out there. And I have to kind of protect that image. Yeah, that's why I do it. So at least I know that when I talk to people, they can take me seriously. Yeah, but thanks for the vote of confidence. Yeah.
Zamani, there you go. So the last question, you know, I'm going to ask you actually.
Zamani, though, I need him to stop, you know, like, bashing Cameroonians on his platform. He needs to, yeah, like, I love the platform, you know, and you know, when he started off, I was one of the most, I used to call him up and like,
right,
you can't write this. You have to think this way. You have to, and then at a certain point, I realized he started copying my posts actually a lot. But then over time, I'm just amazed by how he has grown into the kind of fine and ethical mind he has grown. It's a far cry from what it was when he started. I do follow him a lot. Mm-hmm. I read up, and I'm really very impressed. But yes, I was pissed at him because he was talking about, complaining about Cameroonians not promoting their songs and 80-20. And I know that the reality for Cameroon artists is very different from other countries. I feel sympathetic for a lot of artists because I've been there. I know what, you know, I mean, I'm in there actually. And I know what artists go through, you know. And there is no comparison between artists in Nigeria and artists in Cameroon, you know. No matter how much effort you put in Cameroon, there's no way that you can ever achieve, you know, like a fraction of what Nigerians achieve, you know, unless by some streak of luck, given the current circumstances that we're in. And I do find that sometimes we just need to be more sympathetic with artists, and we might not understand that if we're not in their shoes. But that doesn't take away anything from the wonderful, you know, like the, just the strides and the progress that our bloggers like Zamani, Future have made. You know, I'm really impressed, and you know, big shout out to them.
All right. So as the last question that we always ask every guest is, when all is said and done, how do you want to be remembered as Waxley?
Wow. Those are life defining questions. Like, I should actually maybe write an answer like almost when they ask me, I can respond. You know, it's interesting because, as I said, it's a good way to start and a good way to end. As I said, you know, at the start of the interview, you know, your values change.
Yeah.
And you start to ask whether you want to remember that all, you know, at a certain stage, because it suffices to have a good life and to have a good family and to be at peace with people that you love. You know, that is really all, you know, I guess. I'm not saying I want to be forgotten.
Yeah, sure.
But I'd rather die happy than to be remembered, you know, for, you know, for something that made me sad.
Yeah. That's a deep one. It's a deep one, a deep way to end this interview.
Yeah.
Wax, I want to thank you very much for making our time. I know how busy you are. And that's exactly why when I sat down to write an email to you, I needed to go as detailed as I wanted it to be, because I truly, truly value your time, your expertise. And just, I really want to thank you as well, just for the level of experience. I don't think you've shared most of these things on an interview before. So just being here, sharing from that world of experience, you might think that you're just sharing, but it's affecting me even more than I think it's going to affect the people. I go back on these interviews, I watch them a bunch of times, and I reflect on them. So thank you for at least opening my brain as well. And I do appreciate you for doing this.
And thank you for the time that you prepared the interview. I can see that you, you know, quite, you know, we can't really take that for granted. I really appreciate you. Yeah. And yeah. I hope that the audience is not too disappointed in both of us here.
Oh, no way. Not after this.
All right.
This episode, then the chances are that you're going to love other amazing episodes that we have recorded. So don't forget to check that out in the description. And also please hit the follow button so that you can get notified every time an episode goes live. Down in the description below, you're going to find links to connect with a guest, as well as links to other really helpful resources. So don't forget to check that out. And like I always say, my friends, cheers to many more years of shamelessly living and crazily excelling passion and purpose.